The bottom line in business talk. Voice America Business.
Welcome to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf, your source for total wealth management. All comments, views, and opinions expressed on the show are solely those of Roe, his guests, and callers. Now let's begin the show. Here's your host, Roe Diefendorf.
Thank you for joining us on Three-Dimensional Wealth. I'm your host, Roe Diefendorf, and I'm here today with Penny Castle. Welcome, Penny.
Hi, Roe. Nice to be here.
Well, good. I'm going to give you a little introduction in a minute, but I'm just going to tell them about the topic of the show, and that's really elder care plans need careful planning. And that's a big field these days, and Penny is what I would call the expert here on Long Island. And let me read you some of her bio, which I think is pretty interesting. Penny established her own law firm, and she's got offices in Garden City, Long Island, Hopog, Kew Gardens, and East Hampton, and that basically runs all of Long Island. She comes to the legal profession with a unique background. Penny has a master's degree in counseling, which ties in very well with our three-dimensional wealth counseling that we're doing, where we have a PhD counselor on staff as well. But after working with a pharmaceutical company, Penny, after many years of handling personal injury and medical malpractice cases, has spent now the past 17 or 18 years, I think, devoting the majority of her time to estate planning and the administration and elder care matters. Penny's got a number of honorees. She, in 2004, she was honoree of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. She's also been an honoree of the Long Island Alzheimer Foundation, and she served as the chair there for their legal advisory committee and is still active on the committee. She's also the past director of the Nassau County Bar Association, which I'm sure is probably one of the largest bar associations in the country. And she was the former chair of its elder care or elder law committee. She handles elder law matters for the United Federation of Teachers. And she's a frequent lecturer for medical facilities, bar association, financial planners, and community organization. She spends a good deal of her time presenting seminars and discussions to groups of attorneys, lay people, with regard to their elder law matters, guardianships for elderly and infirmed handicap and family members. And we're going to talk about that. And finally, what I want to say, because I've worked with Penny, is that she understands the sensitive nature of elder law matters and planning for the future. And that's what I think her clients appreciate, her general nature, her ability to explain the law, and allowing them to make informed decisions. So, having said all that, again, I want to welcome you one more time, Penny, to Three-Dimensional Wealth.
Thanks, Roe.
Elder care law. Now, I know when I went through all of my graduate school work, that was not a specialty, and it's relatively new.
Absolutely.
Tell us how it came about, and again, how you got from counseling into elder care law. So I'm going to turn the mic over to you.
Well, elder law developed because of the sandwich generation and the aging population, the graying of America, with more and more people needing long-term care. It's really been around much longer than we know of it because it just didn't have a name. So when I got into the field in about 1987, that was maybe a year or so after the phrase elder law was coined, and some of us, including myself, thought it sort of funny that we had to give it a name, but without a name, nobody really does know of it, and it has grown monumentally since then. I just got into the field really serendipitously because when I started my own practice, I was doing all medical malpractice and personal injury, and we were looking to expand the practice, and I met somebody who just made me aware of this field and that it was going to be a growing field, and I just happened to get into it at the right time.
You know, some people have the impression that elder care law is all about just the ins and outs of how to qualify for Medicaid and get eligibility and how to, you know, get as much out of the government and give as little away. Is that all it's about, or is there something else we're missing?
But there's so much more to it than just that.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, you mentioned a few of the things. Estate planning for younger adults with disabilities. We do a lot of special needs trusts where we, you know, set up a trust that's designed especially for somebody who has special needs, and we want the money to be held for them in trust, used for all of those needs that they have, but not reachable by the government, so that they can avail themselves of government benefits, which they may need. Brain-damaged infant, for example, may have such exorbitant medical costs that any monies they may get as a settlement from a malpractice case or a personal injury case would be exhausted on that those medical expenses, and there'd be no money left for their special institutional costs or for their educational expenses, things like that. For younger people and older people who are in need of assistance in managing for themselves because they lack the ability to do so, we do lots of guardianships, you know, to have a guardian appointed through the court. That's a big part of it. And just general estate planning with sometimes just a little bit different focus on the estate plan, where we're not only concerned with tax issues, but we're concerned about the ability to manage money, protecting money from long-term care expenses is really part of estate planning.
One of the things I think that is true is that when you're doing elder care law, you're dealing with primarily elderly people.
I'll tell you, I deal a lot with the children.
Okay.
I mean, there are plenty of elderly people that I'm dealing with. And I mean, I have to be, because even if I'm doing the advising, if there are any documents to prepare, then ultimately I'm going to be meeting with the seniors to make sure they understand what they're signing, they're capable of signing, so I'll be dealing with them then. But very often other family members get more actively involved, and I may be working more intimately with them.
But I think what it takes on, though, is a unique, it's not just the drafting of the documents, it takes on the part of, and I think where your counseling background comes in, of, you know, how do you educate your clients. You know, this can be a very emotional time when you're talking about potentially having someone who needs nursing home care or needs to be, you know, have the car keys taken away and all of those kind of things. And I think that that kind of legal practitioner with skills that can handle that kind of family dynamics becomes very helpful.
I think so, and that's the feedback I get from my clients. I think, you know, the fact that I'm a woman, you know, maybe a little softer, and I have the counseling background, I have the medical background from my days as a pharmaceutical representative at medical malpractice. My focus is really on educating my clients, and I mm-hmm. think by educating them, it empowers them. That's including the seniors, so that they feel that it's their choice what they're doing, and then they are more comfortable going ahead with it. No matter how comfortable or close a parent is with their child, they still don't want to be told what to do. And so it's very sensitive where, you know, a child might have difficulty steering their parents in the direction that they think they should be going in because, of course, they feel they know what's best for them. But a lot of older people, seniors, they don't like that role reversal, you know, where all of a sudden they become the child and the child becomes the parent. So I think the approach to the seniors is very important, that they feel that they're not being treated like second-class citizens or children, but rather, you know, they're really the client. I treat them and I consider them actually to be my client, even if the child is the one that made the contact. If the parent is there, I want to speak to them and I want them to understand what's happening.
Okay. Now, I've been reading that there are, I think there are some new designations out there, credentials for practitioners in elder care.
Well,
have you seen those, or do you know about them, or can you review them?
There may be in other states. New York State still does not require any special credentials or training for areas of expertise. So, you know, your family attorney down the street could say he does elder law and he doesn't really need any special training or certification. And that is unfortunate because there are some very good attorneys out there who are highly qualified and continually take further education. And then there are those that don't, and they can hold themselves out to be just as knowledgeable when they may not be. And that's the real problem for consumers.
Okay. Well, I'm going to ask you then, there's sort of a series of questions then is one, how does an attorney get the continuing education in that elder care? That's number one. Hold that. The second one is how does a consumer find somebody that's taken that continuing education and can differentiate between, you know, someone who has no experience but yet, you know, says he does? And then I think the third part of that question, if we have time before our break, is, you know, when should someone seek out an elder care attorney? So those are three parts of a question, and let me know what you think.
Okay, now you'll see my age if I can remember all three of them. Okay.
Well, that's why you're on that Alzheimer committee.
You're right, because I need it. Anyway, you get continuing legal education by attending the many seminars and courses that are given by the New York State Bar Association and Nassau County Bar Association, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and so forth. I don't think there's any way that a client or a potential client could really know how much education, you know, an attorney is getting. That's, you know, something that they wouldn't think to ask, and even if they did, you know, the attorney could tell them anything, and I don't think they'd really know. I think the best way to get to the right attorney is through, you know, personal recommendation.
Okay.
But they've got to know who they're getting the recommendation from. You know, they could speak to their neighbor who says, oh, I was to this great guy, and here's his name and number. But how does that person really qualify that attorney? He may not know any better. So I think you have to get a recommendation from people who know. With elder law, I would say the people that really know the most about the experiences with the elder law attorney are those people who work with them, professionals who work with them, like geriatric social workers in the nursing homes and the hospitals.
Well, wonderful. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back, and we're going to talk about commonly used terms in elder law. We'll outline some of those to try and educate our listeners. We'll be right back. Thank you.
Business information you need. From the stock market to starting and managing your business. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Win with effective marketing. Win with proper positioning and branding. Win with Dick McDonald on his show Win-Win Marketing for Buyers and Sellers every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time. On the show, we will discuss the challenges and common mistakes made in today's industry while providing you insight on what you can do to avoid these pitfalls. Get ahead with effective marketing in today's world. Listen to Win-Win Marketing for Sellers and Buyers with Dick McDonald, heard every Wednesday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time here on the Bottom Line of Business, BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
Are you interested in the immigration laws that are increasingly affecting the way we all live? Then you need to tune in to Learner on Immigration every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on Business America Radio. Host Brian Lerner, a certified specialist in immigration and nationality law, will give you updates on current immigration laws and allow you to call in and have your questions answered. The immigration policies of this country affect us all. Find out how on Learner on Immigration with certified specialist Brian Lerner. Heard every Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
Why is Pepsi cooler than Coke? Why are iPods so popular? In 2005, how can you launch a successful brand? Want to know? Learn about the fascinating and intriguing world of graphic design and branding on Design Matters with Debbie Millman. Every Friday at 12 Pacific Standard Time, Debbie Millman will provide you with a provocative look into the stimulating world of design as it intersects with contemporary culture. Hear what the experts have to say about creating, maintaining, and launching a brand in today's challenging marketplace. Join us every Friday at 12 Pacific Standard Time for Design Matters with Debbie Millman, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business, this is Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roe Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roe Diefendorf.
Our show for today is entitled Elder Care Plans Need Careful Planning. And I'm pleased to have Penny Castle Esquire with me. Penny has her own law firm that specializes in elder care law. And before the break, we were talking about qualifications of attorneys and the sort of the new profession. But I just want you to pick up from there, Penny, is when should individuals seek out an elder care attorney? I keep thinking of the situation where I get a call and someone says, gee, you know, my father's got to go into a nursing home. Who do we call? I mean, is it too late? Is it like trying to call the, you know, your property and casualty broker and say, listen, I'd like to insure a house, but by the way, my basement's on fire. You know, when's the right time? Is it too late at that point?
Well, I would say that in my experience, generally, no time is too late. There's generally always something we can do, even at the last minute. But what we can do at the last minute will be much more limited than what we could have done if planning had been done ahead of time. So then you go back to the question of when should you do it? When is it too soon? You know, as opposed to when is it too late? It's never too late. But is it, and you know what, and it's never too soon. Because, as I said in the first part of the show, I think education is really power. And so even if somebody gets an education on the way things work and they don't really need to use it just then, it still puts them in a position of knowing what to do if and when they need it later, or it might even put them in a position of knowing what to do with a situation that they wouldn't have thought of. I'll give you an example.
Okay.
I had a client who came in this morning. He's a client I've been working with in an unrelated matter. And he's a relatively young person, 50 years old, with multiple sclerosis. And he's married, he has two children who are age 20. And because of this other situation that I've been working on with him, it prompted them to come in to talk about estate planning for themselves, where I think otherwise they wouldn't have come in this soon. And, you know, asset protection planning for themselves in the event that his disease progresses, and what if he needs long-term care, how should he protect his assets so that it's there for his wife and for his children. Well, we went into that whole topic. And the bottom line is, you know, they got information so that they're empowered to know what to do for the future. But I still said, I don't think you really need to do anything right now, except for two things. A good, durable power of attorney and a good health care proxy, so that if something happened unexpectedly, I mean, just because he has MS doesn't mean he can't get hit by a car. And then lo and behold, the wife has no ability to access bank accounts, mm-hmm. pay bills, sell the house, whatever. So that's crucial. Power of attorney, healthcare proxy, none of us can ever get them too soon. Second of all, he and his wife are late 40s, early 50s, as I said. They have parents. Their parents intend to leave them their estates when they die. That's imperative that we change the parents' wills. Why should this client come into money when his parents die, and now we have more money to worry about protecting in the event that he needs long-term care? So I suggested that the parents' wills be revised, and they can leave their estates to him, but again, in a special needs trust, so that if he were to need government benefits like Medicaid, if he were in a nursing home, he could still benefit from the inheritance without it being touched by the government. And that's really like giving away snow in the winter, because they're not divesting of themselves of their assets, they're not gifting their assets, they still keep their assets until their death. He inherits as they want him to, but there's no risk to the assets being lost and not, you know, being held on to for the grandchildren.
Mm-hmm. So, we're going to talk about that a little later. I'm just going to go back one more time. I just want to see if someone's going in a nursing home, Penny, I mean, do they want to get there ideally 12 months before, 24 months before, 36 months before? Is there some kind of magical month that they should see you optimal?
Well, see, everybody is different. So what the timing is different for everybody. So, you know, you ask about the timing because you're probably referring to what a lot of people have heard referred to as the 36-month look back
mm-hmm.
with Medicaid. And that's the general rule that if you apply for Medicaid in a nursing home, they have the right to look back 36 months to see if there were any assets in the person's name and he gave them away. But there are a lot of exceptions to that, such as you can give assets to your spouse without creating a penalty. You can give your assets to a disabled child or to a trust for a disabled child, no penalty. So for those people, maybe a month or two before a nursing home, maybe even upon admission to a nursing home is okay. But most of us don't know that, and many of us don't have those, quote, exempt people to whom we can transfer assets without penalty. So certainly 3 years is best, but it's not always essential.
Okay. I'd like you to go through it. You get some of these terms that we throw around in elder law. One of them you said was a healthcare proxy. I'm going to put a few of them together. Healthcare proxy, living will, DNR. We've seen a lot in recent news about living wills. Can you give us an explanation? And you mentioned healthcare proxies again before, but maybe a little more definition so people will understand what exactly we're talking about.
Right. Okay. Well, they all relate to medical decision making. And a DNR is a do not resuscitate order that has to be put in a patient's hospital chart or chart at home if he's receiving hospice care or just care at home. And it means that if somebody goes into cardiac or respiratory arrest, they are not to be resuscitated. Any of us have the right to demand that a do not resuscitate order be put in our chart and carried out if we stop breathing or our heart stops beating. Giving a DNR order becomes a little more thorny when somebody loses mental capacity and the ability to say, I don't want to be resuscitated. Then we have to look to a surrogate or somebody else to speak for us. And here in New York, we have a do not resuscitate statute, which means that there's a list of people in order of priority who can say that the DNR order must be put in the chart if the person's not able to speak for themselves. Then we have a healthcare proxy, which is a legal document that is a creature of statute, which means that we have a law in New York State stating that healthcare proxies are legal and that they're to be honored and what's required in them and so forth. It's a relatively simple document where somebody who's over 18, mentally competent, has the right to pick somebody to act in their place if they can't make decisions for themselves. And that person can make any decisions whatsoever for the patient if the patient can't make decisions for themselves in regard to health care. And that includes a do not resuscitate order. So
okay.
If you have a health care proxy, that's the person who makes the decisions about a do not resuscitate order. And then we have the opportunity to pick a substitute agent or a contingent agent, which we should always have. The only thing that a health care proxy cannot decide is issues in regard to artificial nutrition and hydration, tube feeding, unless the healthcare proxy makes some very clear reference to the fact that the proxy knows the person's wishes in regard to artificial nutrition and hydration. So that's really crucial. So the healthcare proxies is our key healthcare decision-making document in New York. Many people have living wills. Many states in the United States are what we refer to as living will states, where a living will is by law, statute or by law and is honored. New York is not a living will state. We do not have a statute acknowledging the legality of living wills. So living wills in New York are really just one more piece of evidence that a family would have to use if and when they went to court to try to prove what somebody's wishes are. So we never really want to get put in that position of having to go to court and prove somebody's wishes And that's why, in addition to a living will, we really need that health care proxy.
And what would be the difference? What does a living will do differently that the health care proxy would not?
Well, a living will is a written statement that's signed by the person. It says exactly what they want and what they don't want in regard to artificial life support. But it's not written in granite. It's not clear, black and white. They wrote this. This is what must happen. It's up to a court to decide if the living will, if the language of the living will is going to hold up. And we don't want that. We want to just pick somebody who knows what our wishes are, and that person can then make all those decisions.
All right. Before our break, I think you might be have time to talk about durable power of attorney. You talked about that a little previously, but maybe explain in a little more depth.
Right. Well, I like to compare the durable power of attorney to a healthcare proxy in the sense that it's a relatively simple document where you just pick somebody or a couple of people who can act for you. But with the power of attorney, it's in regard to financial and legal matters. And there's no power of attorney that every power of attorney should be durable, which means it remains in effect even after the person becomes incapacitated. Now, there are form powers of attorney that many attorneys use for their clients. Most, I think all elder law attorneys agree that they are very, very, very insufficient because they really don't give powers that are comprehensive enough for most people's needs. So we draw up our own, and we want to give the person who's put in charge the most authority possible so that they can do anything that might be needed.
Okay, so they're stepping in place. Now, a living trust, is that the financial part, the equivalent of a living will? Is that something that...
Well, I'll also just add something that what I've seen, sometimes I see powers of attorney and healthcare proxies combined, and they should never be combined. They should be separate legal documents. The living trust, even though it has the word living in it, just like a living will, totally unrelated. The living will is, again, in regard to health care decisions. A living trust is a trust. And a living trust is a trust that's established during somebody's lifetime rather than through their will at death. And a living trust can often be used as a will substitute, but it's also used for many other purposes.
That's very helpful. And then finally, in your estate planning, you're using a last will and testament. And of course, that's testamentary planning, and I'll let you say something about that.
Right. Well, as you said, you and I are so familiar with the term testamentary, but we forget that a lot of people probably don't know what that means. But testamentary refers to anything at death, and a will is something that goes into effect at death. Whereas a trust, a living trust, really goes into effect during lifetime. But a trust also, although it takes effect during lifetime, it can dispose of assets after death, just like a will does. So they're both means of disposing of assets. The trust not only disposes of assets at death, it also allows for management of those assets during lifetime. And living trusts come in many forms. They can be revocable or they can be irrevocable. And which type of trust we use depends on what we're looking to accomplish, which to me goes to the essence of planning, and that's really trying to find out what the client is looking to accomplish and then putting the right documents in place that will really suit those goals. So many people, for many people, last will and testament will suffice. For others, a living trust will be much better. I tend to use a lot of revocable living trusts for my older clients because not only can we avoid the probate of a will with a trust, but it allows the younger family members to step in and act on behalf of the parents in terms of managing their assets. Much easier to use than a power of attorney.
Terrific. Well, you've given us some real good points here on healthcare proxies, living wills, living trusts, testamentary wills, durable power of attorney. That's a lot to take in for now, but we're going to take a break. We're going to talk about Medicare and Medicaid and some of the Homestead Acts and some other terms that are commonly used in elder law. But we're going to take a break. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with more Three-Dimensional Wealth.
More and more people are starting their day with informative, focused business talk. Top experts. Today's business issues. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
As a financial planner, do your clients really read all that computer-generated boilerplate text in an analysis? The FPS Financial Planning Software is designed for you to show your clients a concise and easy-to-follow report of their financial needs. The FPS system guides your clients to clearly see any needs that they may have in the achieving of their goals. Clients are guided to a decision rather than just reading the analysis. For a free copy of the FPS system, call 1-800-245-1991. Once again, that's 1-800-245-1991.
Are you feeling slammed and suckered in today's stock market? If so, then you need to tune in to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Jordan Kimmel will train you in what you can do to beat up the big boys on Wall Street, as well as share his secrets to success so that you can buy and sell like a profit-pumping pro. Grab the bull market by the horns and listen to Profitable Investing with Jordan Kimmel. Every Thursday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
What stock should I buy?
When is it time to sell?
Where do I turn for honest advice on my portfolio?
For the answers to these questions, tune in to Trading in Today's Markets with Oliver Alvarez and Greg Capra every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. On the show, Oliver, Greg, and their guests will discuss the daily going-ons of Wall Street, as well as give you tips on how to identify the hottest sectors and trends in the market. Improve your portfolio. Listen to Trading in Today's Markets with Oliver Alvarez and Greg Capra. Broadcast live on Business America Radio every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time.
Tune in every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time for The Growth Strategist with Aldana Ambler. On the show, Aldana and some of today's top business professionals will discuss some of today's most pressing business issues that hold you, the business owner, back. Aldana will also give you 21 ways to grow with her list of growth strategies. Grow smart, grow profit, and grow your business with Aldana Ambler and The Growth Strategist every Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
The Bottom Line in Business Talk, Voice America Business.
We now return to Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roy Diefendorf. Direct your questions and comments to www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now the host of Three-Dimensional Wealth, Roy Diefendorf.
Welcome back. My guest for today is Penny Castle, and we've been discussing elder care planning. And in this section, Penny, what we'd like to do is talk a little about Medicare, Medicaid. I find a lot of our clients or people that we're dealing with are confused of what they cover. And so I'm going to ask you to sort of maybe outline those, and we'll take it from there.
Well, the overall difference between Medicare and Medicaid, for a lot of people who forget, you can remember Medicare because of care. It was meant to care for the elderly. It was meant to be a health insurance program for senior citizens. And it certainly has been very effective in that way for many, many years. But now with seniors living so much older, living so much longer, many more of them are ending up needing long-term care in a facility or at home, and Medicare was never designed for that. And that's really where Medicaid comes in. And you think of the last three letters there, and that's aid. And Medicaid was originally designed to be a medical insurance provider, essentially, for the poor. And you still do have to be poor or impoverished to qualify. But most of the Medicaid dollars are really spent on middle-class people who need nursing homes, because Medicare does not cover a nursing home bill but for the first 100 days at most. And many people are in nursing homes much beyond the 100 days. And in New York, at the rate of a good $12,000 a month, most people can't afford to pay it themselves, so they go to elder law attorneys who counsel them on what to do with their assets so that they can qualify for Medicaid eventually.
And so those people that were wealthy at one time, once they go to the nursing home, they become impoverished and they need this anyway. So
that's right. You know, we sort of refer to it as, you know, they really become impoverished just by spending all their money. Or we artificially make them impoverished by having them retitle their assets in different ways so that they qualify, but their assets are protected for other people.
I remember one of our clients, he said, boy, Roe, he said, your dad did a great job for us. He said, putting all the things together, he said, there's only one piece. This is probably 20 years ago now. He said, there's only one thing. He said, we didn't plan on my wife getting Alzheimer and being institutionalized. And at that point, it was probably 12 years already. And he said,
all
of my assets are going. He says, and I will have nothing at the end of this.
You know, that's it. You know, a lot of people ask me, what's the difference between an estate planning attorney and an elder law attorney? And I think the difference is that elder law attorneys are just more sensitized to that issue. And even if it doesn't necessarily apply to somebody, in which case, you know, we do different things or we don't do something, but we're sensitized to it. And everybody can eventually be in need of long-term care. And so instead of doing Medicaid planning, I might be telling them to buy long-term care insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, your more traditional estate planning attorneys may not focus on that part of it. They're focused on only writing the wills and trusts and doing, tax protection planning. And protecting the assets from medical expenses is definitely a big part of estate planning, even for people of wealth.
I was going to say, it's not just for people that we call impoverished. It's for people, all people.
Yeah, well, as I said, you know, if they have wealth and they're never going to qualify for Medicaid, never would want to and should never, they should at least be thinking perhaps about buying long-term care insurance, something that might not be brought to their attention and should be.
Now, one of the definitions I'd like you to talk about is homestead, the home and land that's occupied by a person that's going to apply to Medicaid. How does that work? What's the importance of that definition of homestead?
Well, a homestead's not just a piece of real estate. It's the primary residence where you live.
Okay.
And so we can all, vis-a-vis Medicaid, we can all have only one homestead, even if we have property in Florida and in California or wherever. And in fact, that's true for the IRS or for government, for other parts of the law, I should say, in that we can only be a legal resident of one state, even if we own real estate in different states. And the value of a piece of property being considered a homestead is that it's considered an exempt resource. And in terms of qualifying for Medicaid, although the person applying is only allowed to have a limited amount of assets, he is allowed to own a home of unlimited value, and Medicaid doesn't count it and doesn't touch it in terms of eligibility. But after the fact, if it's sold or at the person's death, there can be a lien put against it. So there are still things we need to do in terms of planning. But that's the importance of a homestead.
Okay, so it's exempt, but there are things that you can do. Can you give us an example?
Yeah, well, like as an example, we talked about a living trust before.
Okay.
And just a simple revocable living trust. So if I had no other recourse, I might, and somebody was about to enter a nursing home, I might put the primary residence into the revocable trust. Now, since the trust is revocable, that's not considered a gift because the person can take it back. Therefore, we don't have any penalty for Medicaid eligibility. So the home is really still considered to be owned by the person who is going into the nursing home and applying for Medicaid. But because the home is a homestead, it is considered an exempt resource. Therefore, they can qualify for Medicaid. Now, generally at death, Medicaid would have a right to put a lien against the home or any other asset in the person's estate. But because the home is titled to the trust, it passes automatically to the beneficiaries and never vests in the person's, quote, probate estate, so there's no lien. So we basically protect the house from that Medicaid lien just by using the trust.
Terrific. What about other things like a life estate or a qualified personal residence trust? Maybe you can define both of those and tell us how they might come in.
Well, the life estate we use a lot in an elder law practice because for many people their single largest asset is their home. And that's the asset that they want so very much to protect for the children. And it's also an asset that's most comfortable for them to retitle to the children because it's not like having no money that they can access themselves and having them really feel poor. So a lot of my senior clients are very comfortable putting the house in the children's names. And to make them even more comfortable, I always recommend that we keep a life estate in the deed for the parents. And that means that they have the legal right to live in and use the house for the rest of their lives. It means that the house really is theirs for the rest of their lives, even though they've retitled the property to the children. It allows them to keep real estate exemptions because of their senior citizen status. It allows the gift to be reduced or discounted in value because of the retention of the life estate, and that, as a result, makes any Medicaid penalty period created smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, if the house is held until after the parent's death, then the children get what is referred to as a stepped-up cost basis, which means that when they sell the house, they will not get hit with capital gains taxes, which they would if the life estate were not retained. So that's really, really important, because most of our senior citizens here on Long Island have houses that have, you know, more than quadrupled in value. I mean, quadrupled is ridiculous. They've bought houses for $8,000, $10,000, $20,000, and they're now worth $300,000, $500,000.
Exactly.
More.
I just had one today. It was $25,000 purchase, current value $550,000.
Exactly. So there's a $475,000 capital gain, if I heard your number, if I remember
right.
The numbers correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, although the parent could avoid some of the tax if they sold it because it's their primary residence, the children can't, and they're going to get hit on all that tax. And if the life estate's retained and the house is sold after death, no capital gains whatsoever. It's a great planning technique.
When would you use a qualified personal residence trust, a QPERT?
I probably wouldn't use it in the context of Medicaid planning.
Okay.
Because we usually use the QPERTs for people of greater wealth who are looking to discount the size of their gift so that they can reduce their ultimate gift and estate taxes. So you're talking about people with larger estates, with taxable estates. And if they fund a QPERT, they're going to create a very large or a very long penalty for Medicaid.
Okay. And it might be more appropriate for someone who has multiple homes, two or three homes, where they can use the QPERTs to discount their transfers.
Absolutely.
Good. Penny, we're going to take a break. Stay tuned for more of Three Dimensional Wealth. Thank you.
Fresh, dynamic, and totally prepared for continuing business education. Business Talk Radio. Voice America Business at voiceamerica.com.
Financial planning can be confusing and complex, and unless you have a solid game plan, you could be taking unnecessary risks and missing out on tremendous opportunities. Let Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates take the mystery out of investing and help you build a solid financial foundation for years to come. Diefendorf Capital Planning revolves around the family, and through our financial service companies and three-dimensional wealth centers, we strive to deliver total wealth management, financially, personally, and socially. Learn more about what Diefendorf Capital Planning Associates can do for you. Visit the website at diefendorfcapital.com today. Integrity, full service, best in class, diefendorfcapital.com.
Technology is changing the way we live our lives and how we do business. On Managing Technology the Right Way, we'll talk about the benefits of technology and the great things it allows us to do, as well as its associated risks. Heard every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, Sun Jogal, the host of Managing Technology the Right Way, will interview business leaders and other experts that have shaped the way we use technology. If you want to keep up with the changing world of technology, listen to Managing Technology the Right Way with Sun Jogal every Friday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
You hear business show after business show all geared towards improving a company's bottom line. But what about your bottom line? How come no one ever talks about that? Finally, a show dedicated to the worker. The Crow Show with Paul McLaughlin, The Work Wonk. Heard every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, The Crow Show is aimed specifically at the worker and their environment. From work skills and technology to dealing with bosses and coworkers, The Crow Show will give you insight on how to survive and prosper in today's workplace. The Crow Show with Paul McLaughlin, The Work Wonk. Heard every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, right here on the Bottom Line in Business Talk, BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
Are you looking for a unique perspective on today's market from an experienced economist?
Well, look no further. Listen to The Economic Contrarian with host Mike Norman every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time on Business America Radio. Mike and his guests will discuss new trends in the marketplace as well as emerging companies and opportunities. So if you want in-depth analysis from a contrarian point of view, don't miss The Economic Contrarian Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Pacific Time right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com.
Keeping you a step ahead of the changing world of business. This is Voice America Business.
Bringing you the keys to total wealth management, this is Three-Dimensional Wealth with Roy Diefendorf. Comments or questions? Visit www.diefendorfcapital.com or call 516-759-3900. Now back to the show. Here's Roy Diefendorf.
Again, we've been discussing today elder care planning, and I have the good fortune to have Penny Castle with me, a elder care attorney. In this final section, Penny, what I'd like to do is talk about hopefully three things. Get a little more depth into the supplemental needs trust. You briefly touched on it. But then also we want to talk about Medicaid qualification steps that are involved. And I think also some of the questions that I oftentimes get are, spend-down requirement, look-back periods, are the penalties. There's a whole bunch of other things I have that I'd love to talk about, but maybe we can start off again just going about the highlights of the special need trust, because I think that we should be using it as practitioners much more often than it is, and I know you use it quite often in your practice, so I'd like you to talk about that again.
Okay. I find a special needs trust to be one of the most useful tools we have. It's like a gift that the government has given us, and you can't use it enough. It's a wonderful thing. But I'm going to start more with Medicaid, and then I'll end up with that, because it'll make a little more sense, I think, in the way I'm thinking about presenting it.
Terrific.
To start out with, like I said, to be eligible for Medicaid, somebody has to be poor. Medicaid's definition of poor is in terms of their assets, not generally in income, at least here in New York. So the assets are the bank accounts, the brokerage accounts, the IRAs, the real estate, etc. When they look at the assets, they eliminate assets that are considered exempt. They don't count them towards that $4,000 figure. And we've already talked about the home as being an exempt asset. Here in New York, IRA and retirement funds can also be exempt assets. Prepaid burial expenses are exempt. And then they also look to the assets to see if an asset is unavailable. And if it's not available, again, they don't count that towards that $4,000 figure.
And what do you mean by unavailable, Penny?
Like assets in a supplemental needs trust unavailable.
Okay.
If you buy an immediate annuity where you invest $80,000, you buy an annuity, and then you have the right only to a distribution each month for a certain number of years or months, then the principal is no longer available. That's considered an unavailable asset.
Okay.
So there are many assets that aren't counted and that we can protect. We could pay cash and we could buy an annuity. We could make an available asset unavailable. So that's the basics with eligibility. If somebody's married, it gets much more complicated, so I'm not even going to go there.
I should say so. Oh, no.
We're not even going to go there. We're not going to have time. But suffice it to
not
say...
Not only for elder care planning, no.
Yeah. But, you know, a lot of people come in, and whether it's their first marriage or their second marriage, the healthy spouse says to me, I inherited that house from my parents. He has nothing to do with that. They shouldn't be counting that, but they do. So they do look at the spouse's assets as well, but we won't go there. Anyway, the spend down, if somebody has too much in assets to qualify for Medicaid, certainly they can spend their assets on any of their needs and expenses, and once the money is down to $4,000, they qualify for Medicaid. Generally, I don't have people spending down too much money if we can help it. And then, as I said, they can convert their assets by taking cash, buying an annuity, putting it in a supplemental needs trust, whatever. And some people divest their assets by giving it away, and gifts are subject to a look-back period, which is currently 3 years, 5 years if the gift is to an irrevocable trust. And that means that Medicaid has the right to look at the gifting. And unless the gifting can be shown to have been done for a purpose other than to qualify for Medicaid, or unless the gift is to certain exempt people, who I mentioned before, a gift to a spouse, a gift to a disabled child, or if it's the primary residence, the gift can be to a spouse, a disabled child, a caregiver child, a minor child, a sister or brother who lives in the house, who has an interest in the house, and so on. Unless we fall within one of those exceptions, then the gift is going to make the person who made the gift ineligible for nursing home Medicaid for a certain period of time. And that period of time is referred to as the penalty period. And that period of time can be 36 months, it could be less than 36 months, or it could be more than 36 months. It really depends on the size and the value of the gift. So the bigger the gift, the bigger the penalty, and vice versa. And that's why when we were talking about life estates before, I mentioned that when a house, title to a house is gifted, we can actually make the gift and the penalty period smaller by retaining the life estate interest.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me just get this right, because I think this is what I heard you say. If you have a caregiver child, that would be an exempt individual?
For the primary residence only.
Oh, for the primary residence only. So a gift always retains a look back. Is that
correct?
Well,
a Medicaid application for nursing home care is always subject to a 36-month look back. And when they look, they're looking for gifts. If they see that the gift is to an exempt person, like if the home is gifted to a caregiver child, then that's the end of that look. I mean, they've looked, they've seen, and okay, that's permissible. But if the gift is the gift of the primary residence to a child who doesn't live in the home, who's not a caregiver, then we're going to have to deal with the penalty period based on the appraised value of the house.
Now, can they give assets to a special need trust for themselves? Or is that self-dealing?
Yes. No, that's a really good question, because that's where supplemental needs trust, to me, get very interesting. Because we really have two types of special needs trust. One is a trust that somebody sets up for somebody else. That's your regular special needs trust. That's,
mm-hmm.
that's just what I call a real special needs trust. And anybody can set up a special needs trust for somebody else, except a husband for a wife and a wife for a husband, or a parent for a dependent child or minor child. But, you know, a senior can set up a supplemental needs trust in their will or as a living trust for their adult child. No problem, and it works the way I mentioned before. All the assets and the income are really available to the child, but not available to Medicaid because they're not counted as available, even though they really are available. Then you have a special needs trust that we can set up for ourselves with our own money. And that's kind of a fiction, because even though it's funded with our own money for ourselves, the person who establishes the trust, really the person who signs on the bottom line and says, I established it, that person's called a grantor of the trust, that can only be certain people, and that's a parent, a grandparent, a guardian, or the court. And the person who can benefit from that special needs trust must be under 65. So that type of supplemental special needs trust that somebody can set up for themselves is really only in certain circumstances. And then another major difference is that when that person dies, whatever's left in the trust gets paid back to the state.
Okay.
Up to the amount that they are due based on what Medicaid has paid for them. So we refer to that type of trust as a payback trust.
Okay. So again, I'm going to rephrase this and see if I've gotten this right. Is it possible then for, let's say, elderly people who are over 65, 75 years old, could they take their assets, $200,000 of assets that they might have, set up a special needs trust for their child, who's age 50, and move the assets to them and still qualify for Medicaid?
Yes, if that age 50 child is under a disability. A special needs trust is only for somebody under a disability.
Okay.
So, yes, if the 50-year-old child is under a disability and they're under 65, then the parents can transfer title of their assets to that trust, no payback because it's a setting up a trust for somebody else, and there's no penalty for Medicaid.
Now, what qualifies for the disability? I mean, you mentioned earlier in the show that you had someone that came in this morning that has MS. They still could be functioning. How does that qualify them for special needs trust?
Absolutely correct. He is functioning, and he may not meet the definition of disabled, because simply being given a diagnosis or a label doesn't qualify him as disabled. You have to qualify pursuant to the Social Security laws, mm-hmm. which means unable to work for at least a year. So if he qualifies for Social Security disability income, that would work.
Well, Penny, this is a complicated area, and I'm glad we can turn to you for advice around here.
Thank
I want to thank you also, Penny, for joining us this past hour. I hope that you've enjoyed our discussion, those listeners. I invite you to join me next week at the same time. And I'm Roey Diefendorf. This is Three Dimensional Wealth. Thank you.
Thank you, Roey.
Business America Radio thanks you for tuning in to Three Dimensional Wealth with Roey Diefendorf. Please join us again next Monday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time for more tips and strategies for achieving total wealth management on Three Dimensional Wealth right here on BusinessAmericaRadio.com. The bottom line in business talk.